So, good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. So, let's see. I'm going to post a link to our PayPal. We'll talk about the seventh tradition later, but I'll just put that in there now so I don't forget. And that's really all the housekeeping that I have. So, for those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. If you could raise your virtual hand or wave at the screen, just make your presence known somehow. I'm going to assume there are some. So if basically there are, BJ is a co-host, Jessica's a co-host, Larry is also running under the banner of questions, is a co-host, and I'm a host. You can chat any one of us. So if there's a female, BJ or Jessica or David or questions, we'd be happy to get you our telephone numbers if you would like. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous says, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight we're very excited to have Danny B. from Houston to come and tell his story. After he tells his story, we'll take a short break at the top of the hour for the seventh tradition, a few announcements, etc. And then we'll reconvene and ask Danny some questions. And he's assured me that there's answers to them. And they're short, monosyllabic answers. In fact, there's only one. But listen, as you think about it, please feel free to send through the chat any questions that you'd like to submit for Danny to the user questions. Larry is kind enough to help us with that. So I am going to get out of Danny's way and welcome Danny.
Thank you. Can you guys hear me okay?
Perfect.
Good, good. Well, my name's Danny and I'm an alcoholic. I'm currently in Spring, Texas, where I have resided for the past 13 years. I came over here for a 3-week job to a town I hated more than anything else 13 years ago, and I'm still here. Found good AA. I belong to the Cypresswood group of Alcoholics Anonymous that during normal times we meet 3 times a day at a clubhouse. We have been traditionally a three legacy group. We like to go out into the hospitals and treatment centers and we don't spend as much time preaching to the choir as we used to, where we get out among them. But that's in normal times. Lately, I feel a little closed in by our circumstance. I'm sure everyone else does, so I won't dwell on that too much. I'm grateful that we have the Zoom thing, although my experience with it has been that it's a wonderful substitute. It won't substitute for the real thing. There's something about being in the room with you guys that I can feel your presence. On here, you can smile and tell me you're okay. But in there, I can see that you might not be telling it exactly the way it is. And this is so much better than us sitting home and just thinking, what do we do? What do we do? Thank God for the technology. I've had the gift of sobriety since February the 18th of 81. That's one of our members ever. At the moment he turns a year or another year, he adds that year on. So he by his math, I'm in my 40th year, but I'm actually 39 years sober, and I'm a very blessed man. I want to say this before I go any further. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't even sometimes when I talk about this with you guys lately, and we haven't been able to hug each other and be in each other's presence, I'm acutely aware of how much you mean to me. And my life for 40 years has just absolutely revolved around you. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous sometime in the fall of 1979. And it was, I walked in, I got a cup of coffee and a brand new life. And I'm eternally grateful for it because I wasn't looking for coffee for sure. And I didn't know I needed a new life. I thought I just needed refinancing. And when I came to AA, I was on my fourth marriage. That's four of them. I was on my fourth marriage and I'd been at penitentiary twice. I'd been mental institutions twice. I'd lived on Skid Row. I'd been imprisoned in Mexico. I had been around the block, and I was 34 years old, and my life was as good as it was ever going to get, which was not good. And I had not a clue what to do. And you could not have told me once that alcohol was a solution for me. You couldn't have told me that if you quit drinking and you come in and sit down with us, that your life is going to turn around. Because I'd quit drinking a number of times and would join a church group or get into some kind of, I'd get put into some forced counseling. And all that ever happened to me was that the longer I was sober, the more irritated with you I became, the more restless I felt, the more. What happens for me is my head starts to kind of race and it makes up stories quickly. It's just amazing how good it is. It knows stuff about you that you don't know about you. And it just goes to work explaining to me the dire circumstances that I face, what I need to do about it, and the story I perhaps need to tell you so that you don't get any closer to me with whatever's wrong with you. What happens is my gut tightens up. My foot starts patting and I start saying to myself, I gotta go. I don't know why I gotta go and I don't know where I gotta go. I just know I can't be here. Wherever that is, I've gotta go. That had been happening to me before I took my first drink. That had been happening to me for a long, long time and it just was normal. I only know that when I took a drink, all of a sudden I thought clearer. I felt less threatened. I felt more like I could be a social butterfly. You've kind of ruined me, but I was kind of an introvert. You know, I got around you and found out you like stories of people who can't put it together very well, and so I'm in. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd gotten out of prison. I got married, we were going to set up house and everything was going to be okay. And in just a matter of months, I'm in a lot of trouble. I have got hot checks out. I can't hold down a job. I've got hepatitis. I'm drunk more often than I'm sober. I'm constantly spinning my wheels, coming up with a plan to pay off the last hot check, to come up with the next story, to try to find a job, to tell her that, I didn't mean to lose my temper, to do all those things, and I'm just worn out. And I didn't have a car, so I stole a car, and it was a terrible car. It was a beat up stolen car, and the guy didn't even want it back. And I uh, I'm riding around in that old car, and I wore an eye patch. There was nothing wrong with my eye. I just thought I looked really mysterious and cool. And it was about all I could afford in bling. And I was drinking with my wife. We had got me out of the hospital, and we were riding around in the car early that morning, having been out all night drinking. And, you know, we were having marriage counseling with you know, passing Jack Daniels between us. And she just got sick of me and stopped the car and kicked me out of the car in front of this nondescript looking building in Midland, Texas. And I was too weak to resist. She just drove off and left me standing there. And I looked up and it said 710 Ohio Street. And I, you know, this was before cell phones. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to go in and see if I can call a friend of mine and get him to pick me up and go save my marriage. And I walked into that place. I opened the door and there were some people sitting over in the corner. And they were playing cards and smoking and drinking coffee. And they saw me. They were very happy to see me. And they invited me in and they started saying things, you know, like, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And I remember thinking, well, I think you're right. I'm not quite sure where you're going with that, but I just kind of like to use the phone. And they would say, they'd offer me like orange juice and honey. And I didn't think that that was something I was interested in. I told them I'm fine. I could just use the phone. They said, well, we're about to have a meeting. If you'll stay for the meeting, we'll give you a ride afterwards. So I stayed for the meeting, and when the meeting was over, it was a lot longer than an hour, in my opinion. And when the meeting was over, they all stood up and held hands, said the Lord's Prayer, and all of a sudden that place just erupted into laughter. Everybody talking at the same time. This was during the smoking days, so you look out across there, and all you could see was really clearly was legs. And everybody's going on, and that thing I told you about started happening. And, you know, my head started racing, and I'm thinking, I got to go. I don't know where I'm going, but I got to get out of here. And I start backing up for the door, and that place parted like the Red Sea. And here walked towards me this dour-looking little guy at a flat top, and he had a young guy with him, and they're heading with a purpose toward me. And I saw him. I thought, oh, hell no, I ain't going anywhere with him. He walked up to me and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to Baskin Robbins for ice cream. Would you like to go? And in my head, I thought, Baskin Robbins for ice cream, be still my beating heart. There is no way on God's green earth I'm going to go off with a bunch of geriatrics for ice cream while my wife is out with her boyfriend. That ain't happening. But what came out of my mouth is, sure, I'd love to go. And I wound up at Baskin Robbins holding a melting Rocky Road ice cream while they pitched me on Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I'm a bottom line kind of a guy. I'm kind of still ADD. I don't want to read the whole book. I don't want to hear the whole story. I just want, let's get to the point. And I want to know if I'm an alcoholic. And I would ask them, I said, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And they would just start telling me about themselves. And I think, what in the world is wrong with you? I don't even care about you, much less whether you're alcoholic or not. I just want to know if you think I am. And they would, the next guy or gal would do the same thing. And, you know, it just seemed to me like y'all were very self-centered and very long-winded. And but I will tell you that if you're lucky enough to stay here long enough, and people, you ask that question often enough, one day somebody will tell you about themselves and you will think that they had just peeked behind the curtain and saw everything about you. I had started hanging around Midland drunk, you know, my mom and dad were there and they watched their house religiously because they knew I was out of prison. I was around, I was drunk, I was broke, and they couldn't trust themselves. It's very sad thing, but that was the truth. They couldn't trust that I wouldn't come get something and hawk it for a drink. And my mom had joined Al-Anon. She had got into Al-Anon and she had gone up to Lubbock, Texas and gone to a conference and heard a speaker. And this Sunday morning while they were at church, I had snuck into their house the cleanup. And I went back into the back bedroom. And my mom, she knew that I came. She always... I lost her about a year and a half ago, but she always knew, and she put a cassette player back there, and there was a cassette of Johnny Harris. And I don't know why, but when I went back there, I remember drinking a glass of water, because you know, remember how thirsty your head's just throbbing. And I looked down and I saw that, and for some reason, I just pushed it in, and I hit play. And Johnny started off saying that a little over 22 and a half years ago, he was wandering around in his cell in a solitary confinement. And he was looking for something. And to make matters worse, he didn't know what he was looking for. And I started crying because that had been my exact experience. I remember being locked up for bad behavior in solitary confinement and just feeling my way around a dank cell, wondering, why am I here? And what am I looking for? And what am I going to do? And how do I get out of this mess? And I don't want to hear, I wasn't raised like this. This is not me. And that was a thing that happened that changed my life, because the seed was planted, you know, that now there's somebody that's like me, and this guy is respected and sober and happy. And here I sit, and one of my reasons that I couldn't do better had just been torn away. My mom and dad were married on Valentine's Day, 1944, and I was born a year later. My mother was 15 when I was born. My dad was 19. He fought in the Second World War. When he came back home, things were pretty, you know, he was twisted up. You know, he'd seen some bad stuff. He came back, and we lived in South Texas, and he dealt with it by drinking, you know. And when he drank, he was fun. He just he liked to let the clutch out and smell the rubber burn. He'd go have fun. And we lived down near the coast, and he'd get me with him. Take me to the bars with him. And we'd go out, and he'd drink, and I'd run around the bars, and it was fun. And he seemed to be in good spirits while he was drinking. But when we come home, my mom was very angry, and because she wasn't having fun. You know, all the money's going out, and her husband's drunk and laying out all night. And he's taking her son to bars. And she finally said, you either straighten up or I'm going to take Danny and leave. Now, my dad, but, you know, I just idolized him. Whenever he was around, I was right there. I mean, I have a memory of him holding me to his bare chest in the backyard and patting my head. And me feeling, you know, I'm safe, you know. Nothing in my world can hurt. Nothing can hurt me at all because I'm with my dad. He quit drinking, and overnight he changed. He became this angry workaholic, and he changed, smoked, and he exploded at every little thing. And I didn't know what was wrong. All of a sudden, the guy that would take me with me and love me and hang on me is screaming at me at every turn, and I don't know what's wrong, and I hide. I have younger brothers, but they're much younger. So my childhood was basically, I was an only child until I was almost 7. And by the time I got to middle school, I'm just twisted up. I got that anxious feeling. I got the things I told you all about to begin with. I'm not a good student. I don't mix well with people. I make up my own friends. I tell myself stories about what's going on, and I have this sense that everybody has an edge on in life but me. And I picked up self-pity probably very, very early. I didn't recognize it as that, but I felt sorry for me. I actually did. I mean, and this turned out to help me with Zoom meetings, but I practiced when I was really young. I would sit in front of a mirror and look at myself, and I felt so bad for me, I'd cry. That worked out later to be a great tool for Zoom meetings. So, because I sit here and stare at myself and sometimes tear up. So I got a little experience. But I got to middle school, and, you know, things are not getting any better. And they show us a film called Duck and Cover. And that's where they show you what to do in case a nuclear bomb goes off in your neighborhood. And, you know, I watched it, and their solution was woefully inadequate. Going out into the hallway and putting a book over your head was not going to cut it. And I came out of there. I just like, I really have got to go now. And I started running away from home. They catch me and bring me back. And finally, they put me in the Big Spring State Hospital, which is the one that Clancy made famous. And I would, stay there and got my psychotropic drugs and get out. And my mom, I come home, my mom's hoping I'll go back to school and I won't stay in class. And I'm just confused. I'm lost kid and I need a drink. I don't know it. I stole my mother's car one evening and I went down to where the cool kids hang out. And I want to go down there. I just want to be a part of them. I go down there and I drive down and I see all these guys. And the moment I get there, I think that's a mistake. I got to go. But they saw me and called me over. And I smoked a cigarette and they gave me a drink. And somewhere in between that drink and some few later, just this magic thing happened. And man, I unwound. I had no clue that you could feel like that. It was just magical. It turned out to be one of the most memorable evenings of my entire life. To this day, I remember it well. It was a perfect evening with a few problems. I wrecked my mother's car. I puked on myself. I got in a fight and got my nose broke, and I wound up in juvenile detention. But other than that, it was a very special evening. They got me out of jail, and I went to, they said, we think you got out of the hospital a little early. They sent me back to the hospital. I immediately escaped. They brought me back and said, if you do it again, we'll give you shock treatments, and they meant it. So I was biding my time. I met two friends there who were getting shock treatments, and we would weave baskets together, and bond and be friends. And we were walking one day from the ward we stayed on to the cafeteria, and we passed a car that was, it was unlocked and running. And I thought, well, is that odd or is that God? I grabbed these two guys and I said, come on, let's go. And we jumped in the car and we took off. And, we made it 38 miles to Midland. And when we got to Midland, we picked up two more guys who should have been in that hospital. And this was very, very exciting time in my life because this is my first gang. I'm their leader. The police are looking for us. The hospital's after us. We're in a stolen car. I mean, it's really, really exciting. I don't think I've ever been that energized before. And I have a plan. We're going south to Mexico. We're going to get to Mexico, and that's just going to solve everything. Now, I'm the kind of guy who will shoot arrows into a wall and then go paint bullseyes around them and then step back and congratulate myself on being a really good shot. And so this is one of my arrows. It's a good idea. We head south. As we head south, these guys' meds begin to wear off. And it became clear they were in that hospital for a reason. And every time we would make a stop to try to get supplies and gas, they would wander off. And it would be like herding cats trying to get everybody back in the car. But we eventually got across the border into Mexico. And I sold that car to a taxi driver for a few hundred pesos, which I thought was a lot of money. It turns out it's not. It's a big stack, but it's very little money. And we went over to Boys Town to a place called the Cadillac Bar. We're having a drink. And this is when I realized I'm completely out of plan. And all of a sudden there was this big commotion. And one of the guys that I had brought with me apparently had some sort of psychotic break. And he killed a parrot that belonged to a lady that worked down there. And it just really upset everybody. And a big fight broke out. And here come the local police and the federales. And I grabbed these guys and I said, we've got to get out of here. We ran for the international border. And they caught us on the Mexican side. And we went to jail in Mexico. And in the big book, in the doctor's opinion, it says that the alcoholic's problems pile up on become astonishingly difficult to solve. Now, this was one of those instances that bore out that truth. Because I'm not bilingual and I didn't know how to tell these people I want my mother. So I'm stuck in Mexico for an extended period. My mother did eventually find me. She bailed me out and left them in there because she thought they were a bad influence on me. And we drove back to Midland. And all the way back, she played Mexican music really loud and quoted scripture. It was her attempt at aversion therapy. And it actually worked. I still hate that music. And we got back to Midland. My mom and dad had a meeting. My dad said he's going to turn 17 in just a few weeks. I think he should join the Navy. And I wanted to say, I have a bulletin for you. I'm an escaped mental patient. But apparently in that year, the Navy had very low standards. And the day I turned 17, I joined the Navy. And it turned out to be a really great thing for a while. I loved being in the Navy. I loved having a uniform. I grew big and strong. I was, for once, I was like everybody else. I had this, on the outside, it looked the same. We marched together. We had the same everything. And I could see myself being a military man, just standing and becoming a lifer. And I'd have grandiose ideas of becoming the top guy. I really wanted to do this. I loved it. And I started drinking at the clubs, and I just had this amazing capacity for booze. I could drink just about anybody under the table and just keep going. And I would have just a great time. I didn't make no effort to control it. Didn't want to control it. I was having fun. I looked forward to going out. We island hopped around the Pacific. I became a CB. I never did actually sail on ships. I ran with the Marines, and we built stuff and fought and just went places, and it was pretty good. But I started having problems with drinking. I started blacking out. I started having these incredible mood swings where you couldn't tell how I was going to go. I might leave in a great mood and wind up in a fight. I might become amorous, and you may already be married. It was just very, very difficult. And I began to shy away from everybody, and more I would drink alone. And everybody else was drinking like I was drinking, but we'd come back and for muster, and everybody would be there all ready to go to work, and I may or may not be there. I may have been in the brig. I may have blacked out and gone somewhere we weren't supposed to go. And I was confused. And I started looking at what I was drinking. And I decided to change what I was drinking. I won't drink tequila anymore, because tequila has a real track record of causing me grief. But it turns out that it didn't matter what I drank. When I took a drink, the drink took a drink. I did not know that I had an allergy to alcohol. I did not know that alcohol was so precious to me, because it solved the problem that I lived with whenever I was sober. Whenever I was sober, I became increasingly more irritable, increasingly more withdrawn, more restless. You know, what's wrong? I got to go. That's what would happen to me. And when I'd take a drink, I just unwind. By the time I was 19 years old, I was really getting into a lot of trouble there, because I just couldn't keep it together. And I got drunk in Guam with some British sailors, went to their ship because they had liquor rations. I don't know how I got on, but I did. I passed out and they went to sea. And that creates kind of a problem, because they always muster when they steam out of a port, and they count, you know, they have the muster, and they have too many sailors. And it was pretty clear who wasn't British. And so they called the shore patrol, and they came out in a launch and got me. And of course, I go straight to the brig, and I'm humiliated. That was never supposed to happen. It's funny now, but then I will assure you it was anything but funny. I was very afraid. I was ashamed. And I'm going to be a soldier. I mean, a sailor. I'm going to stay the rest of my life. This is not a passing thing for me. And yet here I am. I can't stay out of any trouble. I get back to the States, and I wound up going AWOL. I didn't intend to go AWOL. I just went out for a drink, and I decided to go to Texas. And there's a process you have to go through to do that. So they caught me. They brought me back. And I wound up getting a general discharge under honorable conditions. And I left and I was dejected. I had a little bit of money. I went straight to Los Angeles and I lived downtown LA. And I walked the streets and I learned to lie, cheat, and steal and hustle. I learned the difference between between selling blood and selling plasma. I lived in all night theaters and I found out that all night theaters closed at 4 a.m. And I've walked the streets and lived behind dumpsters. And it's trying to get out of LA is even back then was very, very hard. But eventually I got out and I made it back to West Texas. And I was an electrician by trade. My dad was an electrician and he had a business and I went to work for him, but I was this entitled drunk with a real anger problem. And it wasn't long till they had to fire me because I was causing too much trouble. And I started hanging out over in a bar. You know, I just drank Crown Royal and they had guns and girls. And when they came out at night, people stepped away and I counted that as respect. And so I wanted to be like them. And I said my internet's unstable. So am I. At any rate, I started going with these guys. And before long, you know, I've got a car, a gun, I got pills and drink Crown Royal. And I think, well, everybody's got to be something. This is my life. I'm good with this. But the Texas Rangers showed up and everybody was arrested and everybody went to prison. But me, I got a probation because I had not been in any felonious trouble. And while I was in prison, I had a real, you know, that jailhouse conversion. And I really believed it to be real. I wanted more than anything to stop this. This is not the way I want to be. I want to be, my dad is one of the greatest generation. He's a man's man and he, you know, he doesn't lie, cheat, and steal. His word is his bond. My brothers are going to school and getting, you know, they're getting themselves set up to have a good career. And my mom is a good church lady and I'm going to be like them. And I would pray and cry and I wanted out and they gave me a probation. I got out and I lasted 3 weeks. 3 weeks I'm pumping gas on this job I had to have. And I just got angry at this guy that was sitting in his car while I was pumping his gas. And I left the nozzle running and I went into the cash register, made a cash advance, and went across the street and had a drink. When I came to, I was 300 miles away in Dallas. And I hooked up with some guys there that were unstable too. And we started ripping and running. Before long, the police got my dad's place of business staked out. They're looking for me everywhere. I finally get arrested and I got 13 5-year sentences running concurrently, thank God. And I went to prison in Texas. And what I can tell you about being in prison in Texas in the 1960s is it was very time consuming. You just sit there. I didn't drink when I was in prison. I didn't do drugs. I just sat there and I'm absolutely convinced that I came out 3.5 years sicker than when I went in. Because if I got no booze and I got no God, I've only got me left. And the thinking just tightens up and my allergy seems to become more acute. But I would write letters to my mom and we would tell each other stories that this time it's going to be different. And this time I've learned my lesson. And I believed it and she did too. She came to get me and I had made up my mind I'd never drink whiskey again, except on special occasions. And turns out getting out of prison is a very, very special occasion. I got a half pint of whiskey when she came to pick me up. We had a 400-mile ride back to my home. I took a drink, and I hit that sweet spot where the world is just magic. She's upbeat. We don't know anything about alcoholism, but she knows her son means business, and I couldn't have been in a better mood. And on the way back, we're talking about how wonderful it's going to be, and my mom said, son, you need a wife, a kid, a car, a bank account, a job, and a house. You'll be okay. And so I went looking for a woman that had kids, a bank account, a job, and a car, and I found her. And I married her, and my mother was wrong. She was, it was the worst 2 weeks of my life. And I left that girl, and I'm hanging out at a bar that I've adopted in downtown Odessa. And the girl walks in, and I meet her, and we get to talking, and she's crying, and find out that she's pregnant and she can't go home because her folks won't have her home as an unwed mother. So we hatched a plan that night that we would get married. Texas makes you wait 3 days because they want to be sure you're in love. And so we waited the 3 days. We just drank and partied. And when we got to the courthouse, we were both knee walking drunk, but they married us anyway. I called my mother, Collect, and said, "Mom, I'm married." And she said, "I know." And I said, "I don't know how you could. I just did it." She said, "Oh my God, Danny, you have a wife." And I thought, details. I'm always getting tripped up by details. But I decided to go ahead and go on my honeymoon. And we went on our honeymoon, and it's a long ride from Odessa to McAlester, Oklahoma. My new father-in-law picks us up drunk at the bus station. And he's a very influential, he's just a well-connected man. He was in a chauffeur-driven limousine, took us to his big house, passed out. I got up and went outside to smoke a cigarette, and I looked across this big yard, and I saw the McAlester State Penitentiary. I had married the warden's daughter. And I was very, very uncomfortable in that relationship. And so I absconded, which means to move in a secret way. And I made it back to Odessa, and my mother arranged a divorce and an annulment. She still hadn't found out about it. So I got a divorce and an annulment. And I'm living in Odessa, and my mom's, there's a lot of things happen, but upshot of it is I ran into a girl, and oh my God, this one was the one. I really, really loved her. I mean, we fell in love. You don't usually fall in love at this depth until you get to a treatment center. We just really, I mean, it was the real thing. You know how that is. And, but we stayed together for about 3 years, and my drinking was exacerbated by the fact that I'd started doing those little white crosses and those speed pills. And I was psychotic. I was dangerous. I was a very unstable person, and she had to get away from me. We were, I was living out on the streets, running around, found out she was killed in a car wreck. And I don't have any tools for dealing with that. You know, even in inventory, I looked at this. I had no feelings for the lost life, for her family and how that turned out for them. All I felt was, why me? You know, I loved her. Where's mine? And I just wrapped my anger around me like a warm coat. And I got a gun and a bottle of whiskey, and I went on a crime spree, and they gave me 10 years in prison. While I was in prison, I did everything I could to change things. I decided that my real problem now was that I lacked education. I'm a gangster. That's the real problem. If I can get out and hold down a job and I get a little education, I'll be okay. So I worked hard got a high school education, and I started going to college. I studied philosophy. I read wordy books. I did all kinds of things, creative visualization and meditation. And when I got out, I thought, this is it. You know, I'm going to be okay. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. And I'm out, and that old idea is in my mind. I got to be married. That's what you do. You get married, you get a house, you get the kids, and you get all the outside stuff set up. You want to protect that little boy or that little girl that you've had all your life with you. And so what do? You just put a suit of armor on them, and you just take them out into the world, and you never let them see the world. You never let the world see you. You just walk around with this big, heavy armor protecting yourself. And you go home, and you take it off, and you beat that kid up, and you take a drink. And you don't know what you're doing. And I didn't know these things about me because I didn't know about alcoholism. But I'm looking for a wife. And I found her. She was dancing on top of a table at the Discovery Lounge. And man, I saw her. I said, that's her. I was right. I met her. We got all the things. We got the house, the everything. And And I, you know, but I'm drinking. I can't hold down a job. I can't keep it together. And pretty soon I can't report to my parole officer. I can't hold down a job. I'm writing hot checks. And she's the gal that dropped me off in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I'm in so much trouble. I know I'm going back to prison and I'm going to be there for a long time. And I'm running and I'm hiding in AA. And I go from one city to the next. The only place I know where I could hide and not be so utterly alone, I was drawn to you. And I would show up at these groups, and I was that guy, you know, that guy that comes in and steals out of the basket, the guy that hits on the girls, that wants, you know, feed me a fish, take care of me, do something for me. You don't care about AA, you know. And you just see me coming, and you're like, you know, You don't even want me there. But I would tell you what you did. I know what how you felt, but that's not how you behave. I would show up drunk and just be the biggest pain in the butt. And you would say, come on in this house. And you'd offer me coffee. And I remember sitting in a meeting one time, and I was sitting there, and I was kind of just listening to you guys thinking, God, I wish I was an alcoholic. These are the funniest people. I'd give anything if I had alcoholism. This would be so cool. But I'm not like you. I'm a mental case. I'm a thoroughly bad guy. But I sat there and I saw a girl spill a cup of coffee. She was new and she was shaking, and I saw her spill it, and I felt embarrassed for her because you know how we are. I just could just imagine how she felt. And I saw a guy get up, and he went and got a towel and he cleaned it all up, and he said, that's all right. And he got her a cup with a little less in it and gave it to her. And I thought, man, I tell you, I think to this day about that. What love, you know, what absolute caring that we show one another. Those are the things that matter. It's not what you say. It's not what you hear. It's not whether that person's taking the steps right or not. It's acts of love and kindness in the littlest ways that you don't even know that touch another person's heart. And we do it in here all the time. And you don't have to be smart or the best at anything. You're just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you find yourself caring about people. God brings us in here and teaches us to do good for nothing. And we get good for nothing. And then we give good for nothing. I'm so impressed with you guys to this very day, because I see things like that all the time. And so do you. And lately, maybe I'm just getting old, but it really touches my heart. And I sit here and I think, what a fortunate man I have been. I took my last drink in Austin, Texas. I was in the back seat of that old car, and I'd been in and out of the meetings. And I was just leaned out of that car, and I was puking bile and blood. I had 3 old Milwaukee beers left, and I said, God, I'd do anything if I could just get sober. And 2 guys came to get me from the club, and I rode back with them. And on the way back, I looked at John Henry, the guy that came to get me. I said, John, what am I going to do? And he said, Danny, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. I said, well, how do you do that? He said, don't drink right now. And then when it's right now again, don't drink then either. He said, the kid that was with him said, yeah, pretty soon you'll have a minute. And I said, John Henry said, don't pay any attention to him. He said, I'm going to tell you, minutes in Alcoholics Anonymous become hours. They become days, weeks, months, years. You join us in this thing we do, and you'll find yourself a sober, self-respecting member of Alcoholics Anonymous with a host of friends and a relationship with the power that runs this universe. I'm going to tell you that drunk on the way to the club, I was smitten with a magnificent obsession for sobriety. From that moment to this day, I've never wanted to be anywhere else. I've wanted you to be somewhere else sometimes, but I've always wanted to be in this thing. And I'm grateful for that. I started going to meetings, and all of a sudden, I'm getting there early because I got no place else to go. I live in that car. But I'm going to the meetings, and I'm helping set up the chairs. We have clubs in Texas, and so I'm in there helping set up chairs. I'm helping clean the ashtrays, and I'm helping out. And pretty soon, those old guys are saying, you're doing good, kid. And one of them gave me a cassette player with a big shoebox full of tapes. And the people that we listened to all those many, many years ago, I had tapes of them. And I'd ride around and listen to them and laugh and cry and be astonished and just want, I just want to stay with you always. And one day I was riding around so angry because I was like, I'm not alcoholic. I want to be. I mean, that would be so cool. And I said, they're always saying let go and let God. And I thought, let go and let God do what? And then I thought, John Henry will know. And so I headed back up to the club in that car when I got there. He was standing outside. And when I headed up to the steps towards him, I looked at him and I said, John Henry, I'm an alcoholic. He said, yeah, you are. He said, come on in this house. And we went inside and went back in the back. And he told me about himself. And he encouraged me to talk. And I talked to him for a while. He said, Danny, there are people that go to AA that they seem to be okay just showing up and, you know, being a service. They found some friends. And that's great. I'm happy for them. He said, but there are other people in Alcoholics Anonymous who can't stay sober because they're so completely consumed with alcoholism that nothing short of a psychic change is going to change that. And he said, you fall into that class. The guy you are cannot stay sober. You're going to drink again. And I said, I know. And I said, what do I do? And we talked about the first step. We talked about being powerless. We talked about an unmanageable life, which he said, son, that's not just the stuff that you look at on the outside. He said, it's all the times that you've tried to control the way you feel. Everything is about the way Danny feels. Nothing is based on principle. Everything you do, the feeling directs you, and your feelings are all over the place. You're a moving target, and you're just lost. There's a way out. He said, the second step's pretty simple. Second step's about power. You got a choice. You can go to the second step and decide, I'm going to stay with the first step. I'm going to run my life. I've got power. It's a bottle of whiskey. I'll take my chances. Or you can follow our example, and you can get out on your knees now and say a third step prayer with me. And I didn't know what I was praying to or who I was praying to, but I didn't want what I had. And I said, I'll do that. And he said, I want to know that you're willing to go to any length. And I said, I am. I wrote an inventory, and when I finished, I had that fifth step with him. I went down to Town Lake to do 6 and 7. I stepped out of that car, and I had this connected feeling. This feeling stayed with me for hours and hours, and I just knew that I was in the presence of the God of the universe, and everything was going to be okay. Man, I was so happy. And I didn't make a decision. To me, all I ever wanted out of Alcoholics Anonymous at this point was to be free. I just want to be okay. I want to be happy for a change. I've suffered enough. See, the book says we're sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. When you take a step and you get free, you get happy. That's true. But you're not really free. And you don't really know what joy is. You don't know what joy is until you help set somebody else free. When you sit down and pass on what's been given to you in any way you can, it never fails. Joy appears. And all of a sudden, you're connected. And it happens. It's just you can recreate it. Or you can have the worst damn day of your life and be so full of self and make every crappy wrong choice besides drinking and go up to your local club or to your one of your friends who's having a problem, and you sit out and you enter into that spiritual consent with them, and you wind up with two people that experience joy. They're free. They'll go to sleep that night, and they can forgive themselves, and they realize they made a difference where it counts. And we do that over and over and over, and then sell ourselves short, saying, well, I don't work the steps right. I don't do this right. I don't know this. You show up, and you just become willing to grow. You're going to be okay. You're the future of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's going to be fine. It's going to get through all this mess because we need each other. We're a one-trick pony. We don't deal with politics. We don't deal with racism. We don't deal with COVID. We deal with alcoholism, and we do it very well. But alcoholism is primary, permanent, and progressive. You deal with that, and the rest of that stuff will work itself out because you'll have clarity. You'll be at peace. You won't have that meanness. You won't have that separateness. You'll know that everybody's got it going on, and you're just here to help them. We're just here to help God's kids. I made a decision that I would not do all the steps because there was consequences that I did not want to face. I was just going to live underground. I was 6 months sober on five steps, and I just started having a meltdown, and that old "I gotta go" came back, and running drunks around town and going to meetings no longer would work. And I called John Henry and I said, I can't do it. He said, meet me at the club. I met him at the club and I said, John, I just can't take it anymore. And he said, Danny, what's standing between you and that God that you experienced at Town Lake are the things that are on your eight-step list? I said, well, there's some things I didn't tell you. He said, well, what are they? And I told him there was a bank robbery in San Angelo, Texas in the summer of 1980. I was in the area. I'm a blackout drinker. That is my MO. And the police have been trying to find me. They want to talk to me. And he said, well, son, you got to go in and clean that up. I said, oh, no. They're going to lock me up. He said, well, you need to get another sponsor because you will not make it with that. You told me you were willing to go to any length to have this gift. I said, that is theory. This is serious. This they will lock me up for. He said, well, your call, buddy. And he left. I went out in that car and I sat down and I just had this sinking feeling. And I looked up and I said, God, I wish I had the courage, but I don't. I'm too afraid to go. I don't want to spend my life in prison. And all of a sudden, I had this knowledge, this feeling that four walls do not make a prison. Prison is something you carry around on the inside. And I had the keys to the kingdom. I could run like I always did, or I could be willing to surrender my physical freedom to have the gift that you have. I went the next day down to the police department. I parked that old car a long ways away. And I went in and I told them who I was. And they took me upstairs and they showed me a video. I told them all about my good work in AA, of course. They showed me a grainy video of a tall, skinny guy going from till to till. And it was about 15 seconds long. And the second time he played it, I just had this sinking feeling. And I said, I'm so much trouble. I wonder what I did with the money. And he turned around and looked at me and he said, the guy I'm looking for wouldn't walk in here. He said, the guy I'm looking for, he's out there. And he said, we'll find him. But you need to get your skinny butt back to AA. And maybe you can do something about the mess you've created. Now get out of here. I said, I'm in AA forever. I'm not afraid of making amends anymore. I'll make your amends. And I joined AA in earnest. I learned a big lie was lifted. And I've commenced to try to clean up the past. I commenced to try to let God in. I understood that I was a prideful, arrogant, self-serving man that lived that was driven by all 100 forms of my fear. I didn't miss a one of them. And I knew that there was no way that I was ever going to see past that by myself. And so I would turn to God and ask for help and ask you to model that because God works through you. I'd ask God for the courage and then I would look for you for the example. And then I would do what you do. AA is monkey see, monkey do. And I found a monkey that had a big bunch of bananas and he was looking good and I wanted to be like that one. And so I would know how to do these things. And I tried to make amends to my dad. And my dad had gotten to the point when you'd mention my name, he would say, they'd say, how's Danny? And he'd say, Danny who? I was his eldest son and the apple of his eye, and I had been such a stain in his mind that he just completely wrote me off. And I would try to make amends, and I wanted to be in his good graces. But, you know, it just turns out he was just going to be, you know, we'd be cordial. And I would ask you, you know, how long is it going to take? Why do we have to do this? Why can't, you know? And you'd say, everything happens in God's time. Your job is to be willing Your job is to continue to be a good son. You go to work, stay at work, work at work. You become responsible. You help the suffering alcoholic. Do what God puts in your hand and leave your life in his hands. It's none of your business anymore. I was 20 years sober. After many attempts to try to have that conversation, have that bonding, I'd gone home and I was going to spend the night at my parents' house. And I went to an AA meeting at the club I came in. I came home and my mom was waiting up on me. I looked in there and I saw in their bedroom, and I saw my dad. And I looked at my mom and I said, "Is he asleep?" And she said, "He's just pretending to be." And I walked back into his room and he was laying there and he wasn't this big, strong man anymore. Time had worn him down. And I, on an impulse, I leaned down and I kissed him on his old bald head. And I said, "I love you, Pop." And before I could pull away, he reached up and pulled my head to his bare chest and he patted my head. And he said, "I didn't know what to do, boy." I said, "Me neither, Pop." He said, "Those people in AA, I hope you'll always remember to tell them how much we appreciate what you've done for our family. Because you've not only given me sobriety, but you healed the family and you restored a father and son. The things that you do by just coming in and getting your coffee and opening up and opening your heart to the person who's trying to walk in and sit down are so far reaching. You just don't see it sometimes. I wish you could just sometimes step back and see what God's doing through you. You are just the absolutely most remarkable people. I love you guys so much. And man, I hope we can get through all this kind of mess so we can all sit in a room together and have a cup of coffee and tell some stories and laugh. God bless you."
I'm going to allow people to unmute. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Danny.
I need one.
I cried through the whole thing.
That was
but
amazing.
A good cry.
Yeah, it's good to cry with you guys.
Yeah.
It is.
Thank you so much, Danny. I appreciate it.
Love you too, Nancy.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm trying to recover myself. Thank you so much. Okay, so we're going to give Danny a break for a moment, and I just put the chat back in the PayPal. And the Seven Tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seven Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege. I'm going to stop here. Y'all send some questions in now. This is the time to do it. Think them up. Chat them to the host. It's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. You guys send in your questions. Oh, I'm starting to see them come in. Awesome. A word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? I'll take a few by raise of hands. Everybody still choked up? All right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hands or wave. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or you'd like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close this meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. If you're shy, you could also send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right. So, at this point in the format, we are going to ask questions. We got 6 or 8 of them in there now. Please keep them coming. And Danny, someone asks, when someone asks you to be a character reference and they say they have explained their alcohol issues, but later after giving that reference, you find out that wasn't true. Is there anything to do? ? Yeah, I'm going to unmute you. All right, you can unmute yourself, Danny. You're still muted, brother.
There you go. I'll briefly relate a little experience. I have a guy that I put to work. I run a small construction business, and I've often hired guys when I think they're on the right track and they need a job. And this guy was on fire for AA, and he was about to face his 7th DUI, and he'd already been to prison for it. But he was just doing so good and trying so hard, and I'm so proud of him. He asked me if I would go to court and stand up for him. And my partner and I both did. And we were very pleased to be able to say we thought we were talking to a man who was the future. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was going to do well. The judge, our recommendations were heeded, and he was given a probation, which was unprecedented because he'd already been to prison for this. And in a year and a half, he was arrested drunk. And I had to go to prison and revoked, and the court officers were, to say the least, very displeased. And I was first angry at him because I, Danny Brown, had stood up for him and he had let me down. And I had forgotten something that you've taught me, is that I have no power over alcoholism. I can't affect a psychic change. I can't affect your future choices. I can only model for you and try to stay in this path myself. And I'm going to tell you that I will prayerfully stand up for anybody and give anybody a chance if I, in my heart, believe that they're willing to do the deal. Now, if they blow that up, that's on them. Their choice is not on me. It was my choice to say, from where I stand, it looked like a good move. But we all know that alcoholism, being what it is, today you may be fine, and tomorrow it may be a whole different story. So that's my answer.
Thank you. You mentioned a three legacy group. Would you like to share a little bit about being a home group member or what that means to you, three legacy group?
I've had the opportunity to speak around the world a lot. I'm still kind of embarrassed by it and thankful, I still feel like when I show up at those conferences and things, I like, when are they going to get the real big boys and the guys that know what's going on to speak? Because I'm just here. I'm just a guy that was broken and has experienced grace. And so I've worked a lot, and when I would come home, I would travel and work. And then I would travel on the weekends and go. And so my connection to Alcoholics Anonymous became the speakers and the tapers and a few people all around the country. And I would have told you that I was experiencing the best of the best. But what happened is I went bankrupt when I was 26 years sober, and things changed, and I had to settle down. And I was really taken aback. I've kind of gotten full of myself. And I got offered a job by my ex-partner to go to Houston, Texas and work for 3 weeks. And I hated Houston. I'm never going to go there. But I was broke and humbled, and I said, okay, I'll go over there. I went over there. That was 13 years ago. I came into a home group. And as I sat in this home group, nobody's actually asking me to go speak. Nobody wants to know. I really, to be honest with you, I hate to say this, but I really wanted these people who didn't know who I was. I wanted to kind of scatter some of my AA speaker tapes around and say, do you want to call on me next? Listen, it's the truth. That's terrible, but that was me. But they didn't, but they would invite me to go to have coffee with them and to talk afterwards. And they wanted to know how I was doing. And little by little, I began to see that these people were genuinely interested in an anonymous guy that was from Austin. And that I had a sense of humor and they liked that. But they would show up with me and they started calling me and they said, you know, we go down to the Texas House every Wednesday. And it's a good place to meet new people and to pick up sponsees. And they said, it's good service. And I said, well, I'll meet y'all down. And they said, well, we meet usually up outside the club and we go together because it's very unifying and it's a chance for us to do things together to get to know each other really personally. And it's also a good time to find out, you know, how well you're actually doing. We know a little bit about your real recovery because you ride 2 or 3 times a week with people in your home group and you can talk recovery, but in a little while, your actions are going to say that maybe you're cutting corners. So what I've discovered was I'd missed a huge part of Alcoholics Anonymous by being, by cutting myself off from a home group. And I began to stop and look at the very practical things about unity, service, and recovery. And how does that work? It doesn't really work in my life until I'm involved in a home group where I'm there long enough for you to know me, where I'm there long enough for me to trust you enough so that I can recover. Because I'm still a very prideful guy and I don't want you to know that after all this time, I struggle with this or that. And I also found that I wanted to do service on my terms. I wanted to surrender under terms of my own making. I didn't want to go to the Texas House and meet with a guy and listen to inventory on Wednesday night when I had something better to do. And I could speak at a conference next week, and that's service too. And my friend said, that may be, but you know, we have come to believe that real spiritual recovery requires being inconvenienced and that you need to get out of yourself and be there for somebody else. So what you taught me, you took a prideful, arrogant man who had a gift that laid in his lap and then immediately took ownership and congratulated himself on being all that in a bag of chips. And you reintegrated me into Alcoholics Anonymous. You made me your own. To me, that's what it's all about. And that's what we actually have to offer one another. And we don't have to be well versed in all of our literature. We have to get all the way in the middle of the herd and pick up the mop, pick up the literature. Talk to the new guy. Make the old timer feel like he's still needed. Alcoholics Anonymous restores the right way to be in society. We add the value to elder statesmen. We show that the new people are hugely important. And we honor those that are the workers that are in the middle, that are really doing all the job and we don't get any real kudos when you're 4 or 5 years sober and and you're doing all the damn work and nobody does anything except expect you to do it. But you prop us up and we push it off on you. And eventually you say, you know, man, you can still use a broom too. And so that's it. That's my take on it.
Thank you. Well, you'd also mentioned something about no longer preaching to the converted. It sounded like your home group takes commitments into institutions. Did I hear that right?
That is correct. And I've gone back into the prisons because I did not want to go because I left there and I was, that's a chapter of my life that's over. But going back into the institutions is absolutely necessary. They're holding our people hostage and they're telling them what's wrong with them. It's not what's wrong. And when we go in consistently, they may come to our meetings just for coffee and a chance to get out of the cell. But eventually, one of them or some of them will recognize that, we're like you. And I can tell them stories. They can't tell me about prison. I've done my time. And I understand how the system works and I understand how we work. So we're uniquely suited. But if we don't go, there's no one there. They're there for the message. They don't even know they need to hear it. But you carry it. And if we don't go, they don't get it. They come out and they repeat and eventually die in the terrible ways. So we don't spend all of our time in meetings. I think when you spend too much time in meetings, you spend too much time trying to understand the nuances of a step. You want to get weller, you know. Eventually, this is about as good as it gets. We have a saying out in Texas, they say we call it get in the car. Because we're going somewhere. We're not going to sit here and get well. This is, I've listened to your inventory and I have to say this is you might just be okay with this level of well. But it's well enough to help that next guy. And what you'll experience from that is amazing. So there.
Thank you. Somebody wants to know, what state are you originally from?
This will be part of my inventory. I'm very ashamed of this. My folks, we didn't have a hospital in Texas when I was born, and I was born across the state line in New Mexico and lived there for 3 months. And it's one of my big secrets. I'm sorry you're recording this, but I'm actually a native New Mexican. But I lie about it all the time, and I'm going to lie when I get off this one, stay that way.
Texas all the way, right? Let's see. Someone asked, how often do you cycle through the steps?
I don't think there's ever a time. I don't have any set thing. I every time that I sit down kneecap to kneecap with somebody, and they go through the steps, I try to reciprocate, because I find the best way to get someone to open up is to open up. And I find that quite frequently that I open up about things that I had not opened up about before. And I you get a little better, but you get a new level, you get a new devil. So you just got to keep working at it. I personally believe that we don't, some people do the annual house cleaning. If I wait for that long, it really gets a little bit burdensome. I get to rolling sometimes, and I think I know a lot. And you get to a point in Alcoholics Anonymous where you know all the words, but you don't hear the music. And if you want to hear the music, you gotta slow down. This is my experience. I have to slow down. I have to remember that it really means what it says, Upon awakening, consider those 24 hours ahead. Just get back into the day. Don't even step out the door without making contact with God. Sit down, be quiet, ask. You may not get an answer, but you'll find that all through this day, somebody's moving your chips for you. Somebody's moving their checkers for you. And you're aware of it. And at the end of the day, you ask yourself, how much did you heed the call? How many times did you duck because you will? And you ask, I ask myself these things before I go to bed at night. You know, what did I do to help my sobriety? What did I do to hurt my sobriety? And how can I improve that and have a better experience tomorrow and maybe help someone do the same? And that has worked well for me. So as far as cycling through the steps, I think the steps are something that you incorporate on the inside of you and you practice by staying connected with other people. I'm not a guy who will just, I still don't have high enough self-esteem that I'll just sit at home and just keep my spiritual condition perfect. I do better when I think you're watching and I gotta get involved so you won't get ahead of me. God uses my pridefulness to keep me in the game. That's it.
Thank you. The next question says, what does your 11th step practice look like? But you kind of went through it there. And I wonder if you'd like to add anything about your daily living through 10 and 11.
You know, it's a, but that's come up a lot lately. I think because we're all, you know, COVID restricted, we're all like, well, what can I do now? Well, you work on your 10 and 11 step. You know, 10's a little easier because you're not seeing anybody. And 11, you know, it's like, well, maybe I can meditate after all. I'm a big believer in meditation, big believer in it. I do not disrespect it. I believe in prayer and meditation. I have questions about the direction my day needs to go. I have questions about, you know, I assume that there is a power greater than me that has a job for me because I turned my will and life over to it, and I've had a much, much more vibrant life since that happened. So I try to stop and listen. And then I do practice a quiet time where I just try to sit and summon gratitude. I don't do the St. Francis prayer. It's so long that by the time I get to the end of it, I'm usually carrying the trash out. So I'm a guy who does better with a quiet moment to summon gratitude, to be quiet, to invite God in, and to just listen to see if I'm getting any direction. Do I need to call somebody? Somebody's name comes up. Something that I'm struggling with, do I need to talk to someone about it? It says that we really have to get a hold of this vital sixth sense. And I think I spent a lot of time in AA attempting to avoid that because in reality, I like to talk about the vital sixth sense, but I want to run my life. You know what I mean? I want to be nudged by God, but only in the direction I'm going. And so to finally get to a place where I'm going to say, okay, what do you want and where are you and how do I hear? And the thing I do is I say the prayers, I get quiet, I keep pen and paper close by. Something comes up, I write it down, and that's the way I roll. And at night, I ask myself those questions. I ask myself, am I doing this? Or am I just getting up in the morning, saying the prayers, running out the door, creating chaos? I spent a lot of time, treating AA like not for a design for living, but more like a firehouse. You know, where I would go out and set a fire and come in and somebody would say, does anybody have a topic? Well, my hand would shoot up. Yes, I have one. And you guys would gather around and find out what it was and you'd go help me put out the fire. And I have things better and I love you. And then 2 weeks later, does anybody have a topic? My hand shoots up. And my sponsor eventually said, I'm beginning to think you're an arsonist. And he said, I think we should look at maybe taking the matches away from you. Because this is a design for living, not a firehouse that we keep putting out fires for one another. So he introduced me to quiet time, to prayer, to meditation, to service. That's it.
Thank you. We've got two questions on 6-7, so I'm just going to read them both, and we'll consolidate your answer. So would you be willing to share about some of your experiences with step 6 and 7? And then the other question is, how do you actually work 6 and 7?
Yeah, that's the, in most meetings that I've been at around the world, when you bring up 6 and 7 in a discussion setting, you will have long silences because most people don't want to talk about that. And it's a kind of a funny thing. So here's the way I look at 6 and 7. I'll tell you an experience that I had with a member recently that I just think the world of. This person is just on fire, and I'll tell you, it's a woman. There's an arm's length. This is nothing, nothing in untoward here. But she had just busted her butt. She's in everything, every which way, trying to get it done. And she came over to my house with some other people, and she had a meltdown. And I looked at her and I said, "Honey, you're melting down about twice a week now." And she started crying, and she said, "My life's just a wreck." I said, "Well, what's wrong?" And she said, "Well, my house is a complete mess. I'm ashamed of it. I come home and I'm lazy. I just flop down and eat chips and watch TV. And my house is a wreck and I hate it. And I just can't make myself do it. I'm lazy." I know her. And I said, "I would like to submit for your consideration that sometime back you offered me the opportunity to have spiritual consent with you." She said, "I did." I said, "Would you like for me to give you some feedback?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, okay, so here's what I know. I just saw a girl who put herself through nursing school. She did 8 hours a day of nursing, did homework, held down a part-time job, was active in her home group, went and did things for her parents, answered calls for people. And this is the lazy girl. Is that correct?" And she said, "Well, it doesn't sound like it." And I said, "No, it doesn't." I said, "What I think is wrong here with you is that you are misappropriating all of your energies. You put all your energies into what you think we want to see. You're a prideful, arrogant little girl, and it's really gotten hard to bear for you. And the reason that you can't clean your house is because you put all your energy into propping up a phony house to us. We all know that you carry the most expensive purse. You let us know. You also will let us know when somebody else brings one in that isn't. It's a knockoff. You know about it, so you tell us." I said, how does that actually feel to know that you can take someone who took all their money to put out something to cover up their insecurities, and you knocked it off, and you were able to shame them? Isn't that wonderful?" And she cried. And then she stopped and she said, "So what's my problem?" I said, you're prideful, you're arrogant, and you need to be taken down a notch, because when humility enters, you'll be teaching. When humility enters, you can ask God to change you, and you can see experiences, and you can follow us. And she had begun to do that. It's a remarkable thing. I was a partner in business, and I would go in at 10 o'clock and work till 10 at night. It was a construction business. I felt like, and I worked hard. I really did. But because I like to go running in the morning and exercise, and then I'd go to work. But we had a guy working for us who'd been there a while, and he was really good. And we're on a project, and it's not going well. And the guy is irritated with me, his new boss. And he's telling the big boss, my partner, that I'm coming in late and wanting everybody to stay late at work. We start at 7. And my partner said something about it. I got really angry and said, "You know what? I'm an owner here. I don't have to put up with this crap. I work hard." And I mean, I went off on him. And then I called my sponsor later, and I said, "You know, I think I need to buy this guy out in Aurora." What do you think? He said, I think you ought to go home, go to bed, and get up really early and be the first one there. Bring kolaches, have the toolboxes open, be ready to go when they get there, and work hard and be a team player and see how that works. And I thought, I'm going to do that, and that's going to prove a point. And for once, you're going to have to say, I think you need to sell. In 2 weeks' time, my partner and that guy had both individually come up to me and said, man, we're so happy. This thing's going like clockwork. You're fun to be around. You know, you've got good ideas. This is great. I was a little disappointed that what you had said I should do would work. But to me, that is a practical example of 6 and 7. It's realizing out of your inventory, you can't do anything about this. This, you're trapped. Our pride, our ego is so massive, so insurmountable that I think when you get to the back of a fifth step, I think you really need to have somebody give you an honest feedback and just say, honey, I got to tell you, you are a selfish little bee. And if you don't allow this to change, this is the best you'll ever do. And the way it's going to happen is going to be painful and slow, but perfect. And you're going to love who emerges. Because that little girl that little boy that's inside of you, that you want really to be loved and shown into the world, that has to be cracked, and he has to have an opportunity to grow so that the older person that you are and the kid that's in you integrates, and you don't feel fractured anymore, and you're helpful. And you can mentor people. Then you can show people what 6 and 7 really looks like in the real world. That's my take.
Oh, you've been so generous with your time, and just wonderful. And we're out of it, but there are several people who want clarification on whether or not you actually robbed that bank or not.
And I will add me to that list. I'll make this really quick and tell you this that I know. I don't know. I only know that had they pulled me drunk out of a drunk tank and put me in a lineup with my record and my history and my relationship with the authorities, they would have said, close enough, book him, and I would have got time. But what happened is, as I walked in, as you directed, and with power in my back pocket, and I'll never know. Was I capable of it and have I done it? Yes. But I don't have the answer.
All right.
I've been married 8 times. I married 4 times when I was sober. I'm still not good at it.
You're up to 8 now?
Yeah.
Attaboy.
I'm done.
All right. All right. I'm going to share my screen here. And I'm going to ask for a volunteer to read the last 3 paragraphs on page 164 before we close the meeting. Leslie.
Hey, I'm Leslie, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leslie.
A vision for you from the big book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do for each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks for letting me read.
Thank you, my dear. Everyone is allowed to unmute. Let's have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer, and then you'll have an opportunity to to thank Danny. Moment of silence. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done,
on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and give us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against
us. Lead us not into temptation,
lead us not into temptation,
but deliver us from evil.
Deliver us from evil.
For thine is the kingdom, power and glory, forever and ever.
Forever and ever.
Amen.